And we're in the thought turn for this afternoon's workshop, so I ask you for your patience, and please stay awake. It makes my job easier. Oh, wake me up if I fall asleep, please. We're going to talk about fear, and then we'll get into some sex inventory. And again, yeah, must be a New Yorker. Again, about sex, we're not only going to talk about sex, but our ideas of roles in relationships, our interactions with others. And that was a new area for me to discover, because I always thought when you wrote sex inventory, I had to do with that and that only. And there was a pretty neat surprise to take a look at what I thought my role was as a man in a relationship and how I thought a woman's role ought to be in a personal relationship or in other relationships. And what it allowed me to do was very recently just drop so many attachments, get rid of so much ego and delusional thoughts about how I thought a man ought to be in a relationship, what I thought a real man was in a relationship. And I will tell you, it was frightening, but also freeing, because I was able to let go of that stuff and just be. And listen to what God guides me through my heart and say what I feel. And be. And not wondering how I'm going to be perceived by others, because that's bondage again. So it was pretty neat to have that happen, and it was very unexpected recently. There it was. Pretty neat. We're going to talk about fear first, and on page 67, last paragraph, in referring to fear, the third sentence, it says, "This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling?" And we need to examine every area. How many times did I set the ball rolling? One simple way I set the ball rolling, if I'm in fear, I'm usually in self and stopped turning to God. If I'm in self, I'm in fear. If I'm fear, I'm in self. And you know what? I'm experiencing some of the bedevilments on page 52, uncurrent unmanageability, because I'm experiencing some current agnosticism. I don't think God's going to work in this area. So what happens? I need to put my hand in the wheel and take over instead of letting God run the show. Now, doesn't mean I become, I can't think of the word, where I don't take responsibility. Sometimes we get into this thing where, well, God's running the show while the house is burning down and I'm not calling the fire department. No, God gave us our book, says brains to use. We take responsibility. So I do whatever God allows me to do. I take responsibility. I say what I need to say. I take certain actions. But the end result is always in God's hands, and that's where the comfort kind of comes in here. But if I'm continually running the show because I don't think God's going to give me comfort, then I'll experience fear, and fear will run my life. Not too long ago, I felt like I had my back against the wall over some areas of my life. And my prayers in the morning came down to, "Father, please give me comfort today." And I was done. That's all I could come with. That's all I could come at God with, was, "Please give me comfort today, because what's coming down around me is way out of my hand. I don't even know what to ask for anymore. All I want is comfort to get through till tonight, get through this day." And I thought I was experiencing current agnosticism when I said this prayer, and I thought I was sound asleep when I said this prayer, and my sponsor told me, "You were absolutely wide awake." Because the reality was, I was made right-sized again, knowing I don't know what I need to get through a drama of life. And all I wanted to have comfort through this, father and child. A child goes to his father when he hurts, and that's exactly what I found myself doing, but I didn't know it at the time. I felt myself being weak and cowardly for even offering this prayer, because I was reduced to nothing on this day. I got through it fine. Some bumps and rows, a couple of black and blues along the way. But I'm here this morning, and this afternoon, I should say. Last sentence on page 67, it says, "Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble." You ever make a decision based on fear or take an action based on fear? Does it ever turn out to be right? Usually you have to cover up. A lot of today's problems are because of solutions to yesterday's problems. It says we reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper, even though we had no resentment in connection with them. So we list our fears also. And there's certain things to consider. We ask ourselves why we had them. Why do I have these fears? Like our columns with resentments. We ask ourselves the same thing. Why do I have this fear? Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. It wasn't the solution. It may have given us some temporary relief when I'm running the show, but ultimately I hit a wall, and it doesn't go far enough. It is not a solution to my problem. God is. Some of us once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem. It was not a solution, or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse. Perhaps there is a better way. We think so. We are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. This two paragraphs we're going to read became a prayer for me that I work with out of a meditation. These two paragraphs, if we look at the words closely, it's prayer throughout. It says, we're now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role He assigns. I'm not assigning you a role, and I'm no longer assigning me a role. God has a role for me to play. Am I awake to that? Because when I'm trying to play a role other than what God has for me, guess what? I'm hitting a wall again. Just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us and humbly rely on Him, does He enable me to match calamity with serenity? What a great promise. Whatever our calamity may be, and for you it may be a broken shoelace, for someone else it may be the loss of a job or a loved one. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is the way of weakness, paradoxically is the way of strength. The verdict of the age is that faith means courage. All men have courage. I used to think if you had courage, you never experienced fear. That's a lie. The reason why I have courage is because I'm facing my fears and walking through them. A spiritual warrior goes to change, goes through change, because the fear, the pain of not changing is greater. So I may have fear. I may feel like my back is up against the wall, as you may. But the courage comes in with this power when we're able to walk through those things and talk about those things, whether it be to a spouse, a child, a sponsor, whatever it may be, about our legitimate concerns and fears. That takes courage. I would always look at that as being weak and cowardly. It's just the opposite. Because rubber hits the road there, we're putting our neck on the line when we do this stuff. But God moves us. There's a great amount of freedom in doing that. Most people receive that and embrace that too. That's what I have found. If I'm turning in order to go out, if I don't turn in, I will go without. Turn into this power, even though I may be scared to death. Courage does not mean I don't have any kind of fear. It says the verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. When Columbus was going across, you know, the ocean, I'm sure he was waiting like, Jesus, I hope it doesn't really come. I hope it ain't flat, man. Let's hold on.
Those guys want it right.
He kept going, you know. It says they trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be. Be. At once we commence to outgrow fear. I work with these two paragraphs for a long time. I still work with them. They became my personal prayer. Father, direct my attention to what You would have me be, because many times I don't know. And sometimes be is just to be with this power and do what's ever in front of me, because I'm in the world to play the role He assigns. And many times I want to assign me and everyone else a role. You know what I found? I was just sharing with Linda recently that things were happening in my life and I was able to take my hands off the wheel and just go with it. Things were happening. I mean, they were happening a couple of weeks ago in just so fast. Great things. Great promise. Great hope. And I says, now, about 2 hours ago, I was looking and said, wait, let me figure this out. Let me run the show here. And something said, just be. And things were happening. I mean, it was what a terrific experience. Pretty neat.
A as Peter was saying in the middle of that last paragraph, he was sharing about all men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him, we let God demonstrate through us what He can do. I get up each morning and I ask God, I'm calling out to God. I ask Him to give me inspiration, give me intuitive thoughts, decisions. Because what I'm here for today is to be of constant help to others. And I have to trust that He's going to do that for me. I have to trust that He's going to do that for me. As Peter mentioned, we all are going through difficulties in life. Okay? We are all experiencing bumps in the road. The way I perceive it, too. Peter, I can only see to the end of the room, the way Peter said. God could see all the way to the other side of the planet. I can't see what's happening. I must trust Him. And it's He's demonstrating Himself through me of what He can do, not what I can do. Because He has all the power. I have none. And we ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have me be at this moment. Because usually when I'm in fear, I'm a maniac if I'm running my life on my will. But the promise is once we commence to outgrow fear. Now Peter's going to talk about his Elmer Fudd experience in sex.
Boring, man.
He thought he was Don Juan. He came out as Zelma Fudd.
Tells us to direct our attention to what He would have us be. One of the great practices we can work with is in a meditation, in paying very close attention to our breathing, in walking, paying very close attention to our walking. And being still in that moment and mindful of that moment, breathing in this moment, bringing out this moment, bringing in the Spirit of God and bringing out the Spirit of God, bringing in air going into my lungs, knowing I'm alive at this moment, and air going out, knowing I'm alive at this moment. There's a gentleman by the name of Thich Nhat Hanh, and he was asked a question, something to the effect of, would a visitor at his retreat, and the question was something like, the visitor said, all I see you, the monks, do here is eat, and walk. And he says the difference is when we eat, we know we are eating, and when we walk, we know we are walking. They're very much aware of the present moment. And I can take certain disciplines like my breathing with meditation or in my interactions with others. I can listen to the silence between the words someone speaks and be very much awake to that moment and not waiting to jump in. Listen to the silence between the words. When someone speaks, I listen, I hear, I am here now, and I'm able to be. There's great practices to be awake to this present moment. Very simple practices, but practices and disciplines nonetheless, and it takes some time. I can't will myself into being awake to the present moment, nor can I will myself into being a spiritual guru. I'll get taken there if my Father wants me to be there, but I have responsibility to work with some disciplines. I breathe in this moment, I breathe out this moment, and I'm here. Mindfulness of this moment. Listen to the silence between the words when someone's speaking. Try to do that. You know, when someone's speaking to you, especially if it's a prospect, you're already ready to rapid fire some answers because we're giants in AA, right? Just listen to the silence between the words. And you know what I found out? Many times, if ego doesn't answer, because it usually answers what it already knows, the conversation goes in a completely different direction than I thought it was when it started. Just let someone speak and listen. And I will be here with you now. Let's talk about sex. Watch these two guys over here. It says, now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there, and I'm so glad they wrote that down, because when I came in here, my sex ideals and goals were completely backwards and upside down. As I said earlier, my ideas in 1988 when I got here of how a man ought to be and how a woman ought to be and the roles in relationships were so distorted based on old, very old belief systems. and I wondered why I had conflicts in my personal relationships. But above all, we try to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is the lust of our lower nature, a base necessity for procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, or it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow man no flavor for his fare. The other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. So when someone shows up to me with their inventory in step five and they're reading their sex inventory, my job is not to judge. We don't want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't, and that was comforting to hear. What can we do about them? Well, here are our instructions. It says we reviewed our own conduct over the years past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Who did we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? It doesn't say what we could have done instead, because we didn't have the power to do anything than other what we were capable of doing at that moment. But once we were awake, now we're brought to a different place. We have some responsibility to live along spiritual guidelines.
Okay. So in the sex conduct, I'm writing down a list of all those that I've had relationships with. And when I do that, I'm asking these questions on each one. Where I'd have been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate. But the key question for me, which was a powerful question and actually turned out to be my sex ideal, is what should I have done instead? What should I have done instead? And I found out with the number of people that all these people that where I was selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate, who I hurt, okay, you know, just treating people miserably, inconsiderate. And then I'll go ahead and I'll put down exactly what I should have done instead. And that shows up in the next paragraph. In this way, we try to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? We ask God to mold our ideals, and this is a prayer. We ask God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. We remembered that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised or loathed. So I have a sex ideal, and what it really turned out to be was not only for my future sex relationships. What came off the pen was what my relationship should look like to others, period. To all. Okay.
Page 69. It says, whatever ideal turns out to be, and I was instructed to write out a prayer, my sexual goal and ideal, how I would like to see that area of my life, my personal relationships with others, with women, be, or a particular woman if I'm in a relationship, how I would like to see that grow. What would be my goal and ideal for this relationship, for me to be in this relationship? It says, whatever ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends we have done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. Step 9 says, except when to do so would injure them or others. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with persons is often desirable, but here's a condition here, but we let God be the final judge. No one can judge my sex situation. If they want to, so be it, but I let God be the final judge. I heard a gentleman say he has prospects come to his house and they're confused about a lot of things. And they're asking him for the solution, for the solution, for the solution. And he says he asked them to close their eyes and think, if I came to you with the same problem, what would you tell me? We all know what we have to do. We all know. We all know what the right thing to do is by the time we're here. We just have to turn to this power to get it. Who's being selfish? Who's being jealous? Who's being inconsiderate? Who's being dishonest? We know what needs to be done. We do. The condition, the bridge, or the gap that we need a bridge to get over is the power to do it. We know what to do. A gentleman cheating on his wife knows that's the wrong thing. A gentleman coming home and abusing his family knows it's the wrong thing. You know that. What are you going to do about that? We know. We're waking up. They've given us some four-step promises here that tell us we're waking up. And they're going to read them in a second. But there's some warnings they talk about here. Suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. Does that mean we're going to get drunk? Some people tell us so, but this is only a half-truth. It depends on us and our motives. If we are sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we will be forgiven and we'll have learned our lesson. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, clear-cut information here, we are quite sure to drink, period. We are not theorizing, these are facts of our experience. To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity and strength to do the right thing, and that is a prayer. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. If we have been thorough about our personal inventory, we have written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed our resentments. We have begun to comprehend their futility and fatality, promise. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness, promise. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, promise. For we look upon them as sick people, promise. We have listed the people we have harmed by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can, another promise. We didn't even discuss this in step five yet. But they're telling us this stuff was starting to happen, and based on my experience when I was writing this, I remember experiencing something, I didn't know what it was, but I look back on it now and it was a shift. In this book you read again and again that fate did for us what we cannot do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. If you have already made a decision and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you have made a good beginning. Remember that word? They never say we're done. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself.
I just want to refer again on the sex situation there. It said in that paragraph up there, if sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping with others. I'm sorry. Prior to that paragraph, it says, if we are not sorry, if our sex conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We are not theorizing. These are facts. These are facts out of our experience. My experience with this entire book, I do the things that they ask me to do in this book, and I experience the promises. I don't. I will experience the consequences. And they come very subtle, but the end result is that I'm going to be facing a very harsh wall.
Okay, chapter 6, into action. We're going to try to get through steps 5, 6, and 7 by the next hour and come back tomorrow and finish up this work. We'll see what God's got for us, okay? Into action, page 72. It doesn't say into easy does it, into one day at a time. Into let the steps get you.
Into osmosis.
Into osmosis. Into action. Having married our personal inventory, step 4, what shall we do about it? We have been trying to get a new attitude, step 2, with our a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, step 3, and to discover the obstacles in our path, step 4. We have admitted certain defects and we have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. these are about to be cast out. Cast out, I'd like you to circle those two words. It doesn't say we're going to deal with our defects or we're going to work on them. We're going to embrace them and see where they take us. They're going to about to be cast out like garbage in the garbage we take out to the trash can, right? We don't let it lay around the house and see what happens. We get rid of it. Remember, we're going to face and be rid of the things in us which are blocking us from the power. Now they're about to be cast out, done away with. Let's clean out the room to make room for new. This requires action on our part, which when completed, we will mean that we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. This brings us to step 5 in the program of recovery mentioned in the preceding chapter. It says, this is perhaps difficult, especially in discussing our defects with another person. It's a force feeding of humility that goes on here, but what is needed? We think we have done well enough in admitting these things to ourselves. There is doubt about that. Here's a warning. In actual practice, we usually find the solitary self-appraisal insufficient. Writing inventory and sticking it in the drawer is insufficient. I need to be spiritually accountable to someone, and someone or persons must know about me. Because ego will do my thinking for me if I don't do that stuff. Many of us thought it necessary to go much further. We will be more reconciled to discussing ourselves with another person when we see good reasons why we should do so. The best reason first. If we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. Time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives. Trying to avoid this humbling experience, they've turned to easier methods. What happens? Invariably, they get drunk. And having persevered with the rest of the program, they wondered why they fell. You know, sitting down with first time I did this work with the sponsor, I was scared to death going to his house. I'd hit my knees and pray. So how am I going to tell this man all about me, read all this inventory to him, and then share sex inventory with another man? It was not going to happen. And I got that uneasy feeling in my gut, and I had to pray, and I showed up at this guy's doorstep, and I sat down and did step 5 with him. And there were things that I thought he was going to throw me out of the living room with, and he looked bored most of the time, to be quite honest with you. But he shared a lot of similar experiences that he had with me, a lot. And he gave me some information to go out there from there with. Great stuff. And finally, someone knew me, knew all about me. The second time going to this work, I did multiple fifth steps. I sat with 2 people and read fifth steps too. 2 people, same inventory. The first time I was, again, like the first time coming to AA, scared to death reading this inventory. Second time I sat with my sponsor, Mark, and again we went through it and he gave me a different angle on it. And I was freer. Tom and I were meeting up in Harlem, New York, and the topic happened to be fifth step. And you know what? I realized, except when it would be in poor taste to others who were on my list, I was willing to share my entire life with some strangers in a room. And I remember saying to myself, this is what they're talking about when you're in a place of complete freedom. Whatever had to be discussed, I was willing to discuss my life with others. Again, except when it would be in poor taste to other people on that list, I wouldn't do that. But that was a pretty neat deal. The more people who knew about me, who were on this path, who I can keep close to and trust, the freer I get. Great thing about step 5. Page 73. It says, having persevered with the rest of the program, they wondered why they fell. We think the reason is that they never completed their house cleaning. So step 5 is really a part of house cleaning, isn't it? It's the second half of house cleaning. They took inventory all right, but they hung on to some of the worst items in stock. The 2 most difficult things I find people have trouble discussing is things within family and sex inventory. Those seem to be the 2 things that we're all guarded against. My sponsor usually sits down and says, oh, at the beginning, it's okay, what were you not going to tell me? Let's get that out of the way, because then the rest of this is going to be really easy. It says they took inventory all right, but hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egoism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves, but they had not learned enough of humility, fearlessness, and honesty in the sense we find it necessary until they told someone else all their life story.
And they have those 2 words, again, italicized, thought, twice, the delusion of where we're coming from at that point. My experience with the fifth step, it's a cleaning, it's an emptying, everything. In that inventory, it doesn't say it, but I better be writing down anything that I was planning on taking to the grave as well. And I need to share that with another person, at least one person, my entire inventory. More than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He is very much the actor. To the outer world, he presents his stage character. This is the one he likes fellas to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but he knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. You know, like the times at around 3 o'clock in the morning when you wake up. The inconsistency is made worse by the things he does on his sprees. Coming to his senses, he is revolted at certain episodes he vaguely remembers. These memories are a nightmare. He trembles to think someone might have observed. As fast as he can, he pushes these memories far inside him. He hopes they will never see the light of day. He is under constant fear and tension that makes for more drinking. Bottom of page 72. We must be entirely honest with somebody if we expect to live long or happily in this world. It's a warning. I'm sorry, bottom of page 73. Did I say 74? We must be entirely honest with somebody if we expect to live long or happily in this world. Rightly and naturally, we think well before we choose the person or persons, plural, as Peter was saying, multiple fifth steps, with whom to take this intimate and confidential step. Bottom of that paragraph, we often find such a person quick to see and understand our problem. Of course, we sometimes encounter people who do not understand alcoholics. This book was written in 1939, and it was going out off the presses and out where there wasn't any fellowship at all. The only fellowship they had was this book. But today, we're fortunate. There are many people that are on this path, you know, to share this and to understand exactly where we're coming from. And like my friend Mark says, when I ask someone to hear my inventory, on the other side of that table, I don't want someone, Tom, pat me on the back. I don't want that. I want a predator. I want someone to hear something that I can't see, like Peter was talking about, in between the sentences that I'm sharing. Maybe he's seeing some more selfishness, some dishonesty, some fear that I'm not picking up on, or some harm that I may have caused that I can't see. It's important for me. If we cannot or would rather not do this, we search our acquaintance for a closed-mouthed, understanding friend. Perhaps our doctor or psychologist will be the person. It may be one of our own family, but we cannot disclose anything to our wives or our parents which will hurt them and make them unhappy. We have no right to save our skin at another person's expense. Such parts of our story we tell to someone who understands yet be unaffected. The rule is that we must, it's a direction, we must be hard on ourselves but always considerate of others.
When we decide who is to hear our story, I'm sorry, page 75. When we decide who, by the way, I was told I'm talking too fast again.
Doing fine.
I will slow down. When we decide who is to hear our story, we waste no time. We have a written inventory, and we are prepared for a long talk. We explain to our partner what we're about to do and why we have to do it. He should realize we're engaged upon a life and death errand. And we usually decide who's to hear our story by the sponsor because they always want to hear it. Some of us go to a sponsor and others also to sit and prepare for a long talk. I've heard many, many, many fifth steps over the years. And it's gotten to a place for me where you just can look at the body language of the prospect and know they're hitting an area that's really painful and uncomfortable for them to share. My job is to get in there with them and walk them through that. because I've been on the other side of the table when I had some awful things I had to ante up at the table. And I was dying a thousand deaths, but the words were coming out. And the teachers on the other end of the table got in there with me and lovingly walked me through that because they were on the other side of the table. That's what we do. This is not like I'm the sponsor, you're the prospect, and I'm going to sit in this high throne while you ante up. That's not what this is about. That's not what the carpenter want me to do. That's not what God want me to do. We get in there with them, and we pull them through. We walk them through because there are some very tender things on this inventory. So when we listen, how am I listening? And am I listening and watching? I can watch someone's body language and know exactly where we're going. Their body grimaces in pain just by a shift. Just by all of a sudden we lose eye contact. All of a sudden their face is in the paper like this where they're looking up. Or the eyes water. What am I going to do about that? And sometimes they'll gloss, because I did it, we'll gloss over the most painful things that we're begging just to throw out and get free of, and we gloss over it because we're fearful of being judged. And as Tom said, I need to be alert and aware to go in there and kind of get in there and pull them through that and get facts on the table. Because this person will get free when they do that. The great responsibility hearing a fifth step, especially as a sponsor. It says, most people approached in, it says he should realize we are engaged upon a life and death errand. Most people approached in this way will be glad to help. They will be honored by our confidence. And when I sit with someone after a meditation, I usually read this with them. I read this up until the fifth step promises with them, just to remind them of what we're about to do. It says, we pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of carrot, every dark cranny of the past. Here's our fifth step promises. The first time I went through this work, I experienced these promises when I was in 6 and 7 and 8 and 9, but they happened nonetheless. The last time through this work, again, they materialized when I was in 6 and 7. It says, once having taken the step, withholding nothing, that's a condition. We are delighted, that's a promise. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. You know what it's like sitting on your couch when you're untreated and no one's around, where your brain is taken, where your mind is taken you, I should say? Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience, and it may be the infancy of one, but it's happening nonetheless. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. Those are our fifth step promises. Instructions after we're done with step five are as follows. It says, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for 1 hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. We take this book down from the shelf. The last time I did this work, I actually had to put the book up on the shelf and then take it down from the shelf. That's where I was at. We take this book down from our shelf. We turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first five proposals, we ask if we have omitted anything. We read through the first five steps and see if we left anything out. Anything I need to discuss, anything I'm not sure about up until this point. It's a great review within the hour of prayer and meditation, within that hour. It says, for we are building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones for this archway properly in place? Have we skipped on the cement put into the foundation? Taking any shortcuts, leaving things in a closet we should be coming out with? Everything in its place. Great review. Have we tried to make mortar without sand? If we can answer these questions clearly, and no, we haven't left anything out, and we're ready to proceed, it says we can answer to our satisfaction, then we look at step six. We hit step six. And real quickly, the first time I went through this work, it was just following directions and getting moved. The second time I went through this work, when I got my instructions for six and seven, I hit a wall that was a place, I should say, that was one of the most frightening places I've ever experienced in sobriety. I remember hitting my knees with my seven-step prayer, and what it turned out to be was my first step for life all over again. I didn't know it. I felt like I'd never been to an AA meeting, like I had nothing, acquired nothing, never had a spiritual experience. I felt completely void, completely empty, and it was as scary as can be. And what came out of that moment in a prayer to God was, save me from me. What I didn't know then, but I am convinced of now, is when I talked about last night the removal, I talked about today the removal, everything got removed and I was left with nothing. And what was being filled up was the Spirit of God, but at the moment, waking up was certainly not pleasant. I was scared to death. I never forget it. I hit my knees and what came out of that was, save me from me, because I knew me was going to get me in trouble. Completely removed in order to be filled up. At that moment, I was scared to death. It was my first step for life. Didn't know it then. Convinced of it now. It says we look at step 6. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Questions to consider. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Yes or no? Can he now take them all, every one? Yes or no? If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing to be free of that. And we'll get into our 7-step prayer. And as I said earlier, I wrote out my interpretation of the 7-step prayer. And this prayer has very little to do with me, but a whole lot about being of service to God and people around me. And to go out from here, this place in step 7, to do God's bidding, we ask for strength to go out and do 8 and 9, repair the damage we've done, work with some disciplines, and go back into the fellowship and work with others.
So after seeing the things that are objectionable in us, am I willing to have these go? So we say something like this. If you want to repeat after me, we can. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. When I see in that prayer, it's asking me, I'm giving all of me to God as if he didn't have me in the first place. But I'm looking at good and bad, and I really don't know what needs to be removed. I always trust God in the morning by asking him, you know, praying to him and asking him for certain things. And as I said earlier, that he's going to give me this intuitiveness. But I have to be accountable. And that accountability has to come from someone else, usually on this path. Okay. Sometimes it's my wife at home. That objectionable nature of mine, as I said before, I raise my voice, I'm wrong. There's a pull. There's a pull in me. The things that are objectionable to me, I know it, as Peter was sharing about before. I know what's going on here. I'm sensing something's wrong. But that's good. A lot of the times early on on this, when I initially took this journey through the steps, I looked at that and I was angry at me. Because these things that I couldn't pull it off, these things were certain things were still in my life, and I was still getting angry, which is ridiculous because I suffer from this thing called the human condition, and it's going to make some implications later on down the line in the 10th step, like when I'm resentful, when I'm selfish, when I'm dishonest, when I'm afraid. These things are inevitable. They are going to happen. And in review at night, I'm not about beating myself up anymore. And I don't know what to say sometimes. Like Peter was sharing about with another drunk, doing listening to man's inventory. There was an experience one time with a man, and he broke down. I saw him well up. I saw everything coming in, and he just broke down. And I shared, we just happen to have a similar experience based on, you know, what happened when we were kids. And there's a lot of power in touching. There's a lot of power in touching. And I just had to go over and, you know, like, just hold the guy. It's the only thing I could do. I didn't know what to do. I had to pause and ask God and go over and just hold the man. And we got through that. It's a... as Peter said, we'll get into this next one, but we need more action after this. Page 63. Now we need more action, without which we find that... 76.
You said 63.
Get out of here. Oh, you know him?
I think he's drinking.
76, paragraph 3. Now we need more action, which we find that faith without works is dead. Let's look at step 8 and 9. We have a list of all persons we have harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it, the list, when we took inventory, that list of harms. We subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. Now we go out to our fellows. Now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. It doesn't say we wait around, wait for these people to show up. If they show up, then I'll make amends. Okay. It says we go out. We attempt to sweep away the debris which is accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. Here's the implication that we're not running our lives anymore. We're not running our lives. We're trusting God. We're cleaning house. If we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. So if you did that exercise that I shared with you last night and you wrote that out, that yes, I'm willing to do this, and if you don't do this, then you must be a liar. Probably there are still some misgivings, though. As we look over the list of business acquaintances and friends we have hurt, we may feel diffident about going to some of them on a spiritual basis. Let us be assured, to some people we need not, and probably should not, emphasize the spiritual feature on our approach. We might prejudice them. There are some people that are pretty anal about the approach to go. There are certain things that we need to go with when we make an approach to make amends. Okay? But as it says here, at the moment we're trying to put our lives in order. But this is not an end in itself. Our real purpose, and in fact here's the purpose of the ninth step. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. It is seldom wise to approach an individual who still smarts from our injustice to him and announce that we have some religion. We have gone religious. In the prize ring, this would be called leading with the chin. Why lay ourselves open to being branded fanatics or religious bores? There was a man in Alcoholics Anonymous that I hated. We both untreated for an awful long time, and we got into a business together. And the man stole. And then it showed up in my inventory. Well, didn't I stole? Who am I to judge him? Didn't I steal? And I needed to make amends with him, but I hated the man. And he's one of the guys that I didn't want to go out to. God was good. He just happened to show him, bring him up to my life and showed up in my life, and I had to do that. And it was an incredible experience because he saw something. And a few months down the line, I still wasn't too thrilled with the man. But he asked for help down the line. And we did not like each other. But he was set on a path. But why lay ourselves out to be branded fanatics or religious bores? We may kill a future opportunity to carry a beneficial message. but a man is sure to be impressed with a sincere desire to set the right the wrong. He is going to be more interested in a demonstration of goodwill than in our talk of spiritual discoveries.
Same page, next paragraph. Let's go down four sentences. And I think we all experienced this one. The question of how to approach the man we hated will arise. The landlord I talked about yesterday, that I lived in his little studio apartment, I hated this man, and he showed up on my list, and I still experience hate towards him, and I was not yet free. I was making amends, and his name showed up, and I said, I'm not going to him. He owes me an amends. And I was in a restaurant with someone, and I'm sitting down to order dinner, and there was a family gathering in the back of the restaurant, and who was leaning against one of these corner posts like this was this old landlord talking to a gentleman, staring at me, giving me the dead eye. And the sweat was coming off my forehead, and my heart was starting to beat faster, and I was getting very, very, very uncomfortable. And I told the person I was with, I need to get out of here, and she thought I was completely crazy. And I was not yet free. And I remember going to the phone and calling my sponsor, and he told me to meet him at a meeting, and I shared the experience with him. And I said, I think he was talking about me. And he says, well, let's think about this for a minute. You trashed the guy's place. You never made amends. You owe him a whole lot of money. Wouldn't you be talking about you if you saw you in a restaurant? And I realized I needed some work had to be done, and I was not yet free. So what do? Put pen to paper and do more inventory on this gentleman. And I didn't want to do it, but I knew I had to get free of this because I couldn't walk anywhere in my area and not worry about this guy popping out of a doorway. And I wasn't afraid of him for physical harm. It was just humiliation and embarrassment I was still suffering from. I was not yet free. And I got moved to a place with inventory and discussing and a lot of meditation of one Sunday morning waking up. And I was told, when you go make amends, you have an appointment, you'd be the best example of the big book you can be because you may be the only copy that someone reads. And I don't go to their house looking like I'm dressed to commit a felony. I go dressed. And it was a Sunday morning. I was getting dressed with some nice clothes I was putting on. And I had this deep down feeling that I was going to this guy's house, but I wasn't really sure yet. And I realized that when I was putting extra money in my pocket to go make financial restitution. And I showed up at this man's house, and our book talks about how the most difficult ones maybe can be the most beneficial. And I showed up to this man's house on a Sunday morning, dressed like a recovered member of Alcoholics Anonymous. The last time he saw me, I was not dressed like a recovered member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they let me in, and I sat with them and shared the harms I was caused on and anything they needed to tell me that maybe I left out and what could I do to make it right. They were very happy I was not living downstairs from them anymore. They were also very happy that I had my life in order again. And I made the financial restitution to them. And then something happened to me that I'll never forget, but I can't explain. Because when it comes to God, silence makes more sense. In any words I try to give to this experience is only going to fall short due to an injustice. But when I left this man's house, I remember going back to my car to go back to my apartment where I was living. And I kind of remember what happened because it was as if time stopped. And I remember feeling like as if I wasn't touching the sidewalk back to my car. And I had this rush. It was the best word to describe it was bliss. If you ever experienced that, you know what I'm talking about. It was bliss. I was hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. The fifth step promises I experienced in a very profound way after this most very difficult amends. It was a piece of time that I can't really place it. It may have been 2 minutes. It may have been 20 minutes. I can't even tell you. But it was there nonetheless. There have been amends that I have made with my family that were, on an emotional level, the most difficult because they got all of my isms. And I had made lots of sweet promises to them that it was going to stop, and I had to go sit with them. This was a different kind of difficult amends. And I was able to sit with all my family members, past employers, coworkers, all of it. And I know what it's like to get free of that stuff. Going through to work again, I saw some other amends I had to make that I was not aware of until I went through to work, and then it was shown to me. And my two kid brothers, I had to go back and make new approaches to because I realized the first time there were a couple of things that I wasn't aware of that I was very much aware of now, and I had to get that cleared up with them. emotionally draining, but yet very fulfilling. Because I can look people in the eye today and get and be free. My past is no longer haunting me. If I go back and clean up my past, I can be here present. If I don't do that, how could I be present? Because I'm still living in the past and worried about the future, aren't I? Amends is a great way to get free. That's why I said last night, the opening of my talk, if you have any outstanding amends that you're aware of, that you're not taking any action to get right, how come? God, are you shortchanging yourself? And you also do an injustice to people who need the amends. We give people their respect back because we ripped people off. Maybe not monetarily, but emotionally, we rip people off. Not there for our children, not there for our wife, not there for our husband, not there for whoever. Maybe we had a sharp tongue over the years. Lots of things like that. We rip people off. It's all about me and not about you. I need to go back and fix that stuff and give people the respect that they're due as children of God, because God knows when I walk into a meeting or I do harm, you better forgive me, please, right? Forgive us our trespasses, we forgive those who trespassed against us. Think about what those words just said. What does the carpenter say? Before I take the speck out of your eye, let me remove the beam from mine. Oh, but when it comes to me showing up at your door to make amends, well, I only annoyed you. I really didn't harm you. Maybe I should go knock on your door and ask you, did I annoy you? Did I harm you? Rubber hits the road here for certain, for sure. But what if I'm doing this work and I'm being really diligent with it, guess what? I'll experience this power walking to this door, any door I knock on. Like with me with this landlord, I was scared to death showing up at this guy's house. I figured this is going to be an ugly scene, but I was moved to go, and it turned out to be one of the most profound experiences I had in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was many years ago, but I still remember it. I sat with my grandparents to make amends, stole from them, trashed their basement apartment, did a lot of ugly things. My grandmother cried many nights because of my behavior. My grandfather would just get really angry and cry about my behavior. And I was the first born in my family, an Italian family, with great expectations, and I show up and do what I do. And I sat with my grandparents, and I remember showing up their house and sitting with my grandmother and my grandfather, and I started to make my approach, and she started to cry, and then I started to cry, and then my grandfather started to cry, and he don't even understand English. And she was interpreting for him, you know. There was a healing that went on. It was emotionally difficult to sit there and do this. And not out of shame or embarrassment, but how do I give back to people that I now realize, being on the other side of the archway, adored me, and I ripped them off in a lot of ways. How do I show up and do this? And I was moved to do it, and it was embraced, and there was a healing that went on. Great stuff. When I go to my grandmother's house, she doesn't hide her pocketbook anymore. Big book says great events will come to pass. That's a great event for me. You know, she gives me keys to her home. I sat with my dad, who was probably the most emotionally difficult one for me to sit with. He caught all of my mom's illness, and I showed up and goes through it again. And I remember thinking, how do I sit with this man? I mean, he caught all of my stuff. All of it. After leaving off when my mom takes her life and dealt with all of her stuff. How do I show up and sit with this guy besides being scared to death of him? I remember making many prayers, Father, please tell me what to do here. Well, guess what? I show up one day and I ask him if I can sit and talk with him. And I was ready to make financial restitution. That was going to take a long time to get back to him. Because there was lots of money that I owed to this man. And I got halfway, a quarter of the way through this amends, and he stopped me. And he says, all I ever wanted was my son back. And he went on to say some other things to me that I'll hold on to until I go home to the Lord. They were great words. And at that moment, our roots, like Ebby talks about, our roots grasp new soil. We still have our disagreements on certain things. Our outlook upon life is certainly different. But there's a mutual respect and love now because of what happened in this work, what you have given me, and what I was able to do in my amends. Specifically this approach to my dad. Our roots grass, new soil. I sat with my kid brothers who I really just abandoned them, and I ripped them off. I took a lot of money from them. I was never there for them. I did a lot of ugly things that an older brother should not be doing. And I remember I sat with them. The last time through this work, I sat with them again. And my youngest brother, who's a big strappy kid, I mean, he just fell apart. And he says, we always thought we were going to lose you. And I watched my older brother die in front of me. And he had words to that effect. My other brother said, you know, we just wondered what happened to you. You know, I was an athletic type of kid, a clean-cut kid up until a certain age, driven by fear, but I put on a good game face. And then I fall apart, and he wondered what happened to our brother. And I had to go back and make right. And today, God gives me the ability to be the best brother I can to my kid brothers possible. And I'm able to accept guidance and help from them. There's no ego in the way of that. Our roots, grass, new soil. I was able to go back to my former employer and make amends for harms I caused there. I was a longshoreman, and I work with many truck drivers. If there are any in this room tonight, I bless you because you guys helped me so much along the way. I would panhandle in the streets and see truck drivers that I knew from the docks, and I would flag them down in Lower Manhattan by the Manhattan Bridge, looking the part of a Bowery bum and flagging them down and saying, hey, I need some money for my car, it needs gas. Or, can you give me a ride here? I just need some money. And one guy, I remember him saying, I'll pray for you. Another guy said, does your dad know you're here? And they would never, ever, look down upon me or curse me or anything like that. And then when I got sober, I had many, many amends to make to these men. And I did. There was a diner right by my job, and everyone would meet in there. They call it the hole in the wall. And it looked it. And they would all meet in the morning for breakfast, and I would wait outside, and they would come out two and three at a time, and I would say, can I have time to talk to you? And I would sit with them and make an approach. Not one of these guys ever looked down upon me. As long as you're okay, not to worry about it. Your dad always worried about you. I remember seeing this one truck driver who was as tall as the ceiling. He was a monster of a man. And I just did some bad things to this guy, verbal abuse, that he could have knocked me out in one punch. And I saw him, and I said, I need to make this approach. And I never forget, this big strappy man fell apart and gave me this big bear hug. He says, of all the guys down here, I was so fond of you. You remind me of my son. And I thought he hated me. And I made this approach. He gave me this hug. And again, our roots, grass, new soil. Great things, great healing take place in this, yet sometimes we're so fearful about going out and make these amends. Great stuff. There were some amends that I couldn't make because it would cause more harm. On my job, I had no right to go into someone and say, hey, I did these behaviors and implicate other people in that. Hey, I ripped you off for $500 and I'm implicating three or four other people. I have no right to do that, to save my skin at someone else's expense. I have to get their consent first before I approach you. And if they say no, I don't. It's not about putting a notch on my belt and saying, hey, I completed amends and now someone else is in hot water because I wanted to make amends. We don't do that. I don't knock on a woman's door who may be married, who maybe I had an affair with, and say, hi, I'm here to make amends, and her husband wondering what's going on. We don't do things like that. We just don't. I've heard stories of people doing things like that. I need to clear up that stuff in my own home, and I don't behave like that anymore. I've had relationship women that were verbally and one was physically abusive. I'm embarrassed, as I don't say that in a proud way. I was so in the grip of the grapes, I was completely, completely out of my mind about it. I remember coming out of a blackout in downtown Brooklyn, and I was hitting this woman because I wanted the money she had so I can go get fired up. It was a very sick relationship, but I still had no right to do that. Well, how do I go make amends for something like that, verbal abuse and raising my hands to a woman? How do you fix that? You really can't. And I saw this woman, I went to make approach, and she was coming out of a store, and she went directly across the street. She wanted no part of me. And I wanted to tell her, hey, I'm a new guy. You can trust me. She wanted no part of me, and I had to let that be. You know what I do today? I treat women with dignity and respect like they deserve, like children of God, the way I would want my own sister to be treated. That's what I do. I don't 13-step in Alcoholics Anonymous. I never have, thank the good Lord, and I hope you never do that. I don't. My personal relationships in my life are personal to me. I don't advertise my personal life. That's respect. That's what I've been moved to do. Step 9 is just so freeing and so important as to what we do. Again, that's why throughout last night, if you're not taking any action on some amends that you need to be making, how come? Is it possible we have some first-step reservations? Is it possible I became the power? Is it possible I doubt if I'm an alcoholic anymore, of the hopeless variety?
When I initially had my first set of amends, I came up with a lot of harms. There were about 60 people were on that initial list that I had to go out and make amends to. And of course, the first one, a lot of people do it a little differently. I had to make amends to my family first. My wife, it was an experience that I'll never forget. And this was only about, I'd say about 2.5 months from when I began the process. And my wife, we were sitting upstairs in our bedroom. And there were some things that she had some general knowledge of. The book tells me not to be specific. It's not about me, you know, bringing other people's names into it, although she wanted to know some names. she's an American of Italian descent and Siciliano Napolitan, you know, so when I understand those people don't... Well, I've experienced that throughout the years. After all was said and done, and this was in a period of about a few months, like I said, 2.5, 3 months, at the end of that making amends to Jenny, she told me, it went something like this, that, Tom, you know, this, what's happening now in the first few months compared to the last 20 years, of us being together and me and out, in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and her being, having the stick-to-itiveness to be with someone like me. She said, this is like a dream. Peter mentioned before about, you know, when we go out and we clean this wreckage of our past, and we see it before other people. I mean, other people see it before we see it. And that was the first inkling. I knew something was happening. I knew something was shifting, you know. People were telling me that there was a glow about me, but I really didn't sense it. But when Ginny shared that with me, that sort of solidified it for me. I needed to go out I harmed some people in this fellowship. One of my old sponsors, good man, because my wife and I, we were separated, I'd say maybe about 5 or 6 times over that 20-year period. And this man, my sponsor, he was always there for me. Always there for me. You know, he didn't carry this book and share it necessarily the way I share it today. But he found God. So we have no monopoly. Okay, he found God in this fellowship. And he was a good man. And he put me up in his home, you know, when I didn't have a place to go. And I remember when I was out there and staying with him, I started drinking again. And I was in his home, and I would have to go back home. You know, I mean, back to his house. And and I stole from him. And I had to go back. And he, I'll never forget, it was in Brooklyn on a street corner in Brooklyn after a meeting. And I said, Rick, I said, I need to talk to you. So I made my amends to him and I admitted my wrongs. And I says, what can I do to make this right? I have to give you back the money. He said, Tom, he says, I don't know what you're doing in terms of this program of recovery, but you just keep on doing this. And you carry whatever you're doing, just pass it on. Because by this time, it was about 4 or 5 months into this journey, and people from my old home group, his home group, were starting to gravitate towards me, asking for some help. You never know what's on the other side of amends. And I see a lot of people today, or I hear people, when they're in inventory and they write down the names on the inventory. And somewhere, you know, like when it gets down, they have that thought that maybe I should just cross that name off, that really didn't mean anything. But the way it was shared with me, when I'm in inventory, I'm in prayer. In fact, when I'm from the third step prayer to that seventh step prayer, okay, whatever is coming off of that pen and being placed on paper is in prayer. So I trust that God is revealing that to me. So I have no right to take that name off of that paper. If it's there, it's there for a reason. I'm not to question it. And I'll talk it over with my sponsor, and I'll find out what needs to be done to right that wrong. When I sat with my daughters, both of them, I mean, they were very, very happy. My boy, to share something, you know, like in terms of current amends, I shared a little bit ago, if I raise my voice, if I raise my voice in my home, I'm wrong. And my son Tommy, you know, like I've done that. I've been angry at him. And, I mean, but when I get angry sometimes and I'm not in a fit spiritual condition, meaning that, and it's usually that I'm off on one of the sides of the triangle, that I'm not practicing equally, I can get pretty angry. And I can have that same type of behavior that I did in the past. And it happened like this, you know, like quite a few months ago, but it happened nonetheless. And I made amends to Tommy. Now, the problem with my boy Tommy is that every time I make amends and I ask him, you know, how can I make this right, Tom? And he says, don't worry about it. But invariably, the next morning, it always seems like I find a note from him. Dad, you got 20? But like Peter was talking about before, it's not so much in like the money. It's what I stole from people. What I stole from people, their emotions.
Couple of things we can finish up with step nine. Top of page 83, it says, yes, there is a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. A remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fill the bill at all. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it, being very careful not to criticize them. Their defects may be glaring, but chances are that our own actions are partly responsible. So we clean house with the family, asking each morning in meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindness, and love. That's another prayer. It tells me here the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Bottom of page 83 has our nine-step promises, but as we've discovered up until this point, our book is full of promises, many conditions, and many warnings. Page 84, after we go through our promises, it says, well, you know what? I'll read them. How's that? Okay. It says, page 83, it says, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we're halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regress the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. Again, this is like the opposites of the bedevilments on page 52. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. It says, are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize, and the condition is if we work for them. It says, this thought brings us to step 10.